So let's start the call. I just want to remind everyone that this is a peer book discussion group. None of us are licensed medical or mental health professionals. If you have medical concerns, as always, for everything that you do with TMS, it's always very important to make sure that you go get checked out by a doctor to make sure that you're safe. And sometimes, even for the mental health stuff, you may need to work with a licensed mental practitioner to ensure your safety. And we can't determine that. This is just a book group. Check in the chat room at tmswiki.org/chat if you want to jump in and say something. You can always type it there. We also have a link there to our full disclaimer. So today we're going to be talking about pathways to pain relief. In particular, we're going to be talking about the story of Ellen. Ellen is a case history done by Frances Summer Anderson, PhD, SEP, one of Dr. Sarno's most trusted psychotherapists. She is a psychologist and a psychoanalyst and a somatic experiencing practitioner, so a very learned woman. She also has edited two books, and it turns out that this book appeared in one of her edited volumes, a well-known book called Relational Perspectives on the Body. She mentions that in Pathways, and so I sent her an email last week, and I said, hey, is there more psychodynamic content in Relational Perspectives on the Body? And as I read her response, the impression that I got is that roughly there's about the same amount of psychodynamic content in Relational Perspectives and in Pathways to Pain Relief. So that's and there certainly is a lot for us to go on. I know as I reread it, you know, little phrases that didn't seem quite as important earlier seemed more important this time through.
Yeah, the title of that article is Psychic Elaboration, a Musculoskeletal Back Pain, Ellen's Story.
Indeed.
That's the way it first appeared. I thought that it would be a good idea to read as a preamble to our discussion of her dreams, the start of Chapter 11 of The Healing Power of Dreams in James Alexander's The Hidden Psychology of Pain. Dr. Alexander summarizes at the beginning of this chapter. Research recently reported in the Journal of Current Biology indicates that the dream stage of sleep provides us with a form of overnight psychotherapy in that it allows our mind brain to process or sort out experiences. While we are dreaming, the normal stress reaction that goes with upsetting memories and associated stress chemicals are suppressed. This allows our brains to reactivate, put in perspective, and integrate pleasant as well as disturbing experiences, largely without the interference of normal stress hormones that often make upsetting memories overwhelming. As such, the distressing aspects of the experience can be processed while we sleep so that it can lose some of its negative emotional impact on us. And I think this applies in general to Ellen's dreams of the boxers and the rabbit, the cannibalistic carnivore rabbit, and some of the other dreams of the boxer dreams, the more horrible ones that are related later. I think there is a sensor mechanism going on here that shows just how profound the emotions are involved, because if this is what happens in Ellen's mind when she's in a relaxed state, when these, you have to wonder how profound these emotions must be if it has to go through this intervening symbology of boxers and rabbits. What would the real material be like if it ever surfaced? And of course, we'll get into this later. This has to do with her conflicted relationship with her brother, initially. And I've known older brothers who tortured their younger sister. I can recall episodes like that.
Yeah.
but she certainly seems to have buried it for a long time, and it's showed up in her relationship with her her ex-husband, Ted, and with the married man who she met, oddly enough, at the same time as the O.J. Simpson affair, as if that isn't pregnant with violence, and on into her professional and personal relationships in general. So I thought that that introduction just placed her dreams in a neurobiological context. And that's some of the good stuff that Dr. Alexander does, I think. You start to see the overlay, the neurobiological overlay to the psychology of TMS. So I
love thinking about that. Can you tell us a little bit about how that overlay works? Like, can you simplify what Dr. Alexander just said and how it applies to Ellen, maybe in your own words? Like what that means to you, that passage that you just read?
Well, that during sleep, the latent psychological content is released because of biochemical changes that go on during REM. And that's what allows these dreams to surface. And since they're so violent, you can see how they foreshadow or are part of the somatization that goes on in Ellen, where she becomes violently ill and infected. You can see the TMS process going from just psychotherapy to full blast physical illness. There's a very thin transparent layer between just thinking about things and they're actually affecting your physical body that are quite obvious in Ellen's case. This, how long was she in therapy with Dr. Anderson? 9 years? A long time. Until it was actually affecting Dr. Anderson, too. She had to assimilate this. How many infections did she have? Did Ellen have? At least
it was quite
three.
A few.
Yeah, and one of them was life-threatening and sent her to the hospital. It just shows how powerful this material is that's been repressed. That has to give vent in physical symptomology, like
absolutely.
Lower back pain.
And when you talked about it, what I wanted to say is, or when you were reading the passage, what I heard a lot was the idea of safety. That much as a psychotherapist's office is a safe place to explore your emotions, and Dr. Anderson made her office a safe place for Ellen to explore her emotions, it sounds like. What Dr. Alexander is saying in the passage you read is that dreams are a safe place to explore your emotion, where you don't have to worry about the profound stress response which might come on you if you try to explore it in the conscious world. And it also seems to fit in a lot with TMS theory, where the symptoms are created, as Dr. Sarno has made very, very clear, to protect you. That the underlying emotions, these unconscious emotions, could be so terrifying that your brain says, okay, or at least part of your brain, a primitive part of your brain says, I'm going to protect myself by creating the symptoms instead, because that's less of an existential threat to me.
Which is interesting in terms of my own experience, where during the night I would have no sciatica or lower back pain. And as I woke up in the morning, gradually coming into consciousness, into full consciousness, then it would come back. When I woke up at first, there was nothing there. Then as I came into myself, then I would get up and there'd be a click and then I'd have a bad day. But before that, when my mind was still in the dream state, it was safe. And then the repressions needed to start to happen once I woke up to my environment and realized where I was at. Very interesting there, personally speaking.
Yeah, it's amazing how much this stuff kind of connects with our own experiences and kind of the relaxing state of sleep, and how, and when we're sleeping, we're very relaxed to begin with.
And anything can happen, you know, it's a free-form environment.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that. I love looking. I mean, the 1990s were the decade of the brain, and one thing I love doing is, and you know, with Obama talking about this $100 million of funding for mapping the brain, it just seems like there's so much to learn by looking at this new brain science, and thanks for sharing that.
Well, mapping the brain is akin to recording the human genome, the Human Genome Project, but that's only the beginning. Once you've mapped the genome, then you have to understand the interactions between the different DNA molecules, and that's the real work.
Yeah.
The real work will begin once we map the brain.
It will be a long time, and I look forward to learning what we can. Yeah. So our four co-hosts, I want to welcome them today. Bruce has shared that first quote. We also have Enjoy, and we have Eric Watson. I want to thank them very much for joining us. Enjoy, did you want to add anything? You had a chance to take another look at this. I really enjoyed reading your comment on the forum that you posted, I think, on Monday about the book in response to the thread that I started. Did you have any bits that you wanted to add to the discussion today? I know Eric has another one too, but I thought maybe we'd do a little table of contents first.
Well, actually, I just wanted to say in regards to dreams being a safe place to process your stuff, it's exactly the opposite for me. I'm fine during the day. I have lots of tools, and if a memory surfaces or I'm having some emotional problems with something, I can deal with it. But at night, I cannot. And so what happens to me is I have very strange, very bad dreams all night. And whenever I wake up during the night, I'm very aware that all my muscles are super, super tight. And I wake up in the morning and I think, thank God, and I climb back into consciousness and go to work on making the day reasonably comfortable. So it's just the opposite.
Enjoy, this sounds like exactly what Dr. Sarno talks about, where the same symptoms can have completely opposite manifestations, where some people will wake up at 3 a.m. in the middle of the night and have excruciating back pain and have to pop a pill. And then all day long, they're fine. And then other people can sleep like a baby and wake up, and then it starts. There are just entirely different cycles that these psychogenic symptoms can have, pain symptoms, varying from individual to individual.
Maybe to some degree you have to make some decisions about what you can stand and what you can't, and, you know, just to sort of make life as bearable as possible.
And that seems to be one of the things which they did in the therapy session of Dr. Anderson and Ellen, is they said, Dr. Anderson is very, very sensitive to say, are you ready to do this or do we need to slow down? And sometimes Ellen would say, yeah, I think we need to go a little bit more slowly. I'm not quite ready to dig that up. And it sounds like even at the end of the therapy, there were some things which, you know, Dr. Anderson was very clear, like we hadn't yet dug up everything to understand where all of this violent imagery came from. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing. And I think that's important because we want all of our listeners to know that, you know, different people are totally different here. Does anyone else, any of our listeners, just want to chime in? Who's anything we've said made you want to brought any thoughts to mind? What are your experiences of dreams? I wish I remembered my dreams. I don't remember my dreams. Sometimes I can sense that they have a powerful effect on me, but unfortunately, I just don't remember them very well. I really wish I did. Does anyone else remember their dreams and can relate to that?
No. Okay, somebody going to speak? Okay, this is Eric, right?
Yes.
You guys there?
Sure are.
Okay. If anybody else is going to speak, I'm sitting here waiting. But if they're not, I'd like to go ahead and just tell a dream I had, and it made no sense at all, but it was an abstract dream. And then when it came to me, I understood what it meant. Would that be cool?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, great. Now, this is going to be kind of cool because when I had the dream, Lindsay Lohan was at my house, okay? Now, I'd been seeing a lot of stuff about, and everybody has, about Lindsay Lohan and how much she gets in trouble and how much problems she's been having. And, you know, I've been studying a lot about, you know, helping people and things. And as I'm watching it, and then I have this dream, and in the dream she's there, and I don't know why she's there, okay? But I remember seeing her on anger management. And I remember seeing all the times she had to go and get help and all that. But upon awake, I started writing down what I thought the dream meant. And what it came out was a totally different aspect. And what it was telling me was somebody that was needing my help, that was a close friend of mine, really needed me to call him. And that was the conclusion that I came to, because he was always getting in trouble, and she represented him. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But it also took a repression out, because just the night before I was writing about this person, how I wanted to be able to talk to him so he could, you know, have a better feeling about what he was going through at the time. And that night I had a dream about Lindsay Lohan, and it was an abstract dream, and I'm like, wow. And then the next day she was actually him in the dream.
Hmm.
She served as a symbolic intermediary for your friend.
Yes.
That was easily publicly, that was a public figure.
Much like the boxers or the rabbit.
Oh, right. Yeah. So the unconscious seizes on different symbols then that are like something in real life, but have a emotional or a psychosymbolic equivalency.
It was emotional because I had been, you know, wanting this person to ask me this for years, and it was about, you know, getting himself right on track with his own life, and I was just wanting to, for, you know, a brother. I was wanting to do it for years to help him, but I didn't know that was a symbolic dream about him.
I offered to help Lindsay, but she told me to stuff it. She preferred Charlie.
Yeah, that's exactly what she told me in the dream.
Can I make a comment on this?
Yeah.
Jump in at any time.
Okay.
Please.
My favorite book on learning how to understand your dreams is called Inner Work by Robert Johnson, who is a Jungian psychoanalyst. Ooh. And before I ran into Dr. Johnson's work, I never remembered dreams. Now I remember them all the time. So it was very helpful. So it's called Inner Work by Robert Johnson, if anyone's interested. And he would make the point about this particular dream that, yes, it may be about a friend, there's no doubt about it, but it's also about you.
Mm-hmm.
Every single person in the dream is also you. So that is the kind of dream that I think could be mined for many, many, many different interpretations. And very interesting dream.
But that's true in the quotidian day-to-day life, too. Every single person in your environment is also an aspect of you. In fact, some of the people you meet that you don't like really contain aspects of yourself that you don't like,
mm-hmm.
or they repeat again certain relationships you had with superego figures or siblings in early childhood. And you're projecting onto that these relationships, your own experience, and your own conditioning.
That's interesting.
Y'all hit a lot. Y'all actually combined with a great truth there, because if you think about what I said, it was about my brother actually. So it was intertwined with what both of y'all said. You know, I believe. Well, that's what I know. It was intertwined with both, because he's a brother, a family member, and as we all know, if we want to find repressions, go back to the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we can find a lot there. So yeah, both and Joey and Bruce made a lot of sense with that.
Hmm.
But I've also had other dreams that would tell me about my own pain. It would tell me about things that was right underneath my nose, and I didn't even know it. I was wide awake and didn't even know I had these repressions. They wasn't so abstract at the time, but they would tell me upon awake, that subconscious anger that I had, who it was towards or something. So that holds true too with dreams.
Well, you can see how Ellen's relationship, conflicted emotional relationship with her brother, ripples through her relationship with her ex-husband Ted,
mm-hmm.
And her brother Joe leads to her relationship with Ted, mm-hmm. relationship with the married man she meets in the singles bar, and then it ripples through her whole personal and professional life too.
There's a great quote on that which I'd like to read, if I may.
Okay.
Yeah, you have that one, I know. It's your fingertips. I remember it.
Dr. Anderson writes, or it's written collaboratively, so they write, nevertheless, Ellen's gradual ownership of the traumatic experiences with Joe, her brother, that we do know about, has increased her awareness of how she leaves herself open to boundary violations in the present. She has begun to realize with great shame and fear that she has repeated these scenarios with Joe in her relationship with Ted, her ex-husband, with her married lover, and in other personal and professional relationships. And that theme kind of came up of how she doesn't take care of herself to some degree, and she allows these people to hurt her, and we see its roots in childhood. It reminded me a lot of some of the main themes. What I liked about that quote was that it reminded me a lot of the what Gabor Mate said in When the Body Says No. He really emphasized about people with these tough childhood experiences, much of it has to do with boundaries. And later on in the book, Dr. Anderson talks about how Ellen was learning an optimum use of anger and of aggression in interpersonal relationships, including within the therapeutic relationship. Did she have the courage to share that anger with her therapist, because this was a very important person in her life? She had dreams about Dr. Anderson as well, and her relationship with Dr. Anderson, and dreams about whether or not she could stand up to Dr. Anderson. So, you know, being able to express that anger in that relationship was important as well.
I think you notice in Ellen a fundamental disconnect between her ability to feel emotions and thinking. They're separate.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets back to that letter she wrote to Joe when she was a kid, to her brother Joe.
Mm.
I love you, but you be bad to me. Mom gets me and lets you free. That's so pregnant with meaning in terms of their relationship. It summarizes so much. Her mother, I see, she got the feeling that her mother really wanted a boy
mm-hmm.
when she was born, and then treated both of them alike, Ellen got the same hand-me-down cowboy clothes that her brother had worn 3 years before.
Right.
There was an element of competition there, a gap she could never close. And
didn't she also have a brother that passed away, Bruce? The older brother that didn't make it, and they would tell her that they wished that she would have been the one that didn't make it? Well, she was, I think, between like like 2 and 6 or something like that.
Oh, so she was always a failure then for being a girl, period.
Yeah, well, it was all the way back to shame. It was all the way back to her childhood where, you know, this developed. And I can remember back when I was a kid and I would have, you know, something brought up to me about a nephew that my dad was raising. And if anything was brought up to me about the nephew that my dad was raising, it really hurt me because Pop was never there, you know, for me. As a kid, I can remember this. But it never registered to me that that could be a repression. Not that he died, not that the nephew was dead and I was being compared with him, but in a way, I was being compared with him.
Mm-hmm.
So years later, as I started journaling and doing my repression work and everything I was supposed to do for that, that came up. And I had to deal with it. I had to face it and deal with it. And it was a lot of anguish. It was a lot of hurt. It was a lot of pain. But at the same time, I came through it, and it helped me become a better person just by realizing the pain we can go through when we're children. Go ahead, Bruce.
I know that my mother had a baby back in 1930, Phyllis, mm-hmm. by an alcoholic, abusive college man that she took up with out of high school. But the baby died after a year or 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the feeling as a kid in the 50s that I could not, that my mother really wanted Phyllis in me and treated me in many ways like a girl that she didn't have anymore. I think those kind of implicit comparisons in families do really register with kids.
I think that those having that those sibling rivalries, I think, have profound effects on a lot of us. I
yeah.
definitely feel some of that myself. You know, I'm the oldest of a family, and my father remarried. And sometimes I feel like I'm the stepchild. I'm just not as important. And I think that had a big effect on me.
Yeah.
And as you look at Ellen's story, to me, it ties in a lot with what Dr. Sherman was writing and what we talked about was in some of our previous talks of the perfectionism and what motivates the perfectionism. What I remember from what he said about what motivates the perfectionism is fear. You know, we're afraid of being abandoned. And do you remember that, Bruce?
Dr. Sherman in earlier.
Yes, Dr. Sherman in the earlier things, he was talking about how why do we become perfectionists? Why do we become goodists? We're afraid that if we speak up and we articulate our anger, that our parents will go away and will be abandoned. And you know that's the thinking of a toddler. You know, that's when those first nerve pathways were laid down when we were toddlers, and they were just reinforced over time.
So we have to be perfect so we're not criticized. So we're lovable.
So we're lovable, exactly.
Being so good and being so perfect so mommy and daddy won't throw you away in the bathwater.
Exactly. And then there was that dream where that exact same idea showed up for Ellen, where her mother was in a dream, and I think they were on a road trip, and she was going to get out of the car. And there was something about a suitcase, and then she threw the suitcase at her mom, and the fear was that she would lose her mom for good. So that was a terrifying dream for her. And I kind of wonder if, you know, that's why maybe she didn't speak up against Ted, who was physically harming her, as she was afraid of abandonment. And she maybe felt like because she wasn't treated better by her by her parents, they didn't defend her. They really wanted a boy. That maybe that was part of why she didn't have better boundaries, and she wasn't able to say no. This isn't acceptable. You have to treat me better. No, I'm not going to date a married man. No, I'm not going to stay with someone who hits me.
You have to wonder why she entered into this relationship with a married man that was against the background of O.J. Simpson running amok and cutting his wife to pieces with a machete. How did this fire her romantic ardor in this singles bar exactly?
It's a sad story, but it happens a lot, I think. I think that, you know, this type of dynamic, I mean, maybe it's a common psychology, like the TMS psychology is common. And maybe it even has common roots of, you know, childhood trauma and not feeling safe in young attachments. I know Steve talks a lot about tricordification, which is pulling people together. And whenever I heard that, Steve Ozanich, I hear the idea of attachment and what is the solidity of, you know, how solid are the young attachments that people feel, and did they get what they needed, what they really deserved as children?
Wow. Was that a question there? Was that a question? Or
let's turn it into a question. Now let's hear an answer.
Oh, well, I was wanting you to rephrase the question, if you don't mind.
Oh. It wasn't so much a question then.
Okay.
Well, I mean, to some degree, there was a question of, you know, how much of this does come from a common psychology of not getting what we needed as children. We can see that in Ellen's story.
Mm-hmm.
of not getting protection from her brother, from her parents. Her brother would, you know, bully her. She didn't get that. She didn't get a sense of being valued from her parents. Maybe that taught her that she didn't deserve better than what she got. And maybe that's the explanation. That would be my attempt at answering Bruce's question. Why would she meet that guy at the singles bar and be attracted to him? Well, maybe she felt like she could never get any better.
Shame.
Does that make sense to anyone else?
Yes,
but what about the violence behind that moment? You know, we all know what happened in the O.J. Simpson relationship.
Right, right.
It was all over the papers, the same way Lindsay is.
She was so disconnected from her emotions that even at that time, with what O.J. did, it was not, you know, registering from... She's got so much repressed back there that nothing's registering, really. You know, the Ted, I don't think she's paying any attention much to Mark, her husband now, or her person she's with now.
I was thinking was that background of violence might have been curiously attractive to her.
You know, I noticed that we have a bunch of
thought.
Men talking about, you know, the psychology of a woman. I was wondering, are there any women who might be willing to chime in? I just unmuted Becca. If you want to jump in, anyone else want to share their thoughts on what could have led her to replicate these traumas from early in her childhood?
Well, I don't think it has anything to do with the psychology of women particularly, but I've been married for more than 40 years. My husband and I have realized that one of the things that attracted each of us to the other was some of the dark side of our experiences with our parents and our siblings. Even though we wouldn't think that consciously, but now looking back at it, I am in a lot of ways very similar to his older brother and to his mother. And can't get along with either one of them for 2 seconds. He would just get into a fight. It was quite funny, really. But on the and then on the other hand, he reminds me. My father used to have this trick where he would sit me down and he would yak at me for hours. He would ask me what I thought about so-and-so, and I would tell him because I was an opinionated little kid. And we're talking 8, 9 years old, eh? And then he would spend hours talking me out of that. And of course, you know, I'd argue with him as best I could at whatever age I was, but I wasn't very effective, of course. And sooner or later, it would overwhelm me emotionally, and I'd start to cry, and that would just make him madder, because my father had this theory that women were fine, except they should be more like men. So I was supposed to be you know, tough, right, and stuff. And I was pretty tough, but, you know, no, you could take only so much of a big guy that's, you know, 6'2" yelling at you before you get upset. And so I'd get upset, and then that would make him worse. And then so finally I would just sort of crack, and I'd say, okay, fine. You know, you're right and I'm wrong. And then he would turn around without a break and tell me that that was wrong and try and talk me back into what I thought before, right? So it was really incredibly abusive. But, I mean, now I realize that he was just, you know, A, nuts, and B, trying to teach me analytical, you know, thinking type skills. I was female and therefore emotional or something. You know, who the hell knows what he was doing. But anyway, oddly, my husband, who is nothing like that, has, because of his own background, he's sort of, you know, he's getting over it because, you know, we're both pushing 70 now. But he has the idea that, or he had the idea as a child that other people couldn't possibly know something if he knows something, everybody knows it, right? Because he had the impression that
because it's just common sense.
He didn't know that. He didn't know he was very bright. He thought everybody else was smarter than him when he was a kid, right? So he would do, I mean, not nearly to the extent that my father was doing it, but he would try and explain to me, right? Explain something to me. So I finally got to this stage where I couldn't do it anymore, and I thought, well, okay, this has got to stop, and I couldn't make any sense to him. So I would just say, shut the fuck up, or I will put a stake through your heart.
Oh, yes.
I did. I seriously did, and yes. That stopped, you know, because he thought, oh, okay, I guess she means it.
Like, yeah, that's sincere.
He didn't have any sisters, right? He only had this nasty older brother who reminds him of me because I'm bossy, you know, and his older brother was bossy. And so he didn't know about women. He thought of women as, you know, sort of very different than you would if you had a sister that you had interacted with. So, and my father never had a sister, right? So neither one of them had a clue what to do with a female. and so it was a big long learning curve. But the thing is that what I was going to say is that we both did the same thing. We both married somebody who had the characteristics of our childhood traumatic experiences. And I think, I mean, I've read somewhere, and I think it's very true for me, is that you do that. And I think Ellen did that with the guy in the mm-hmm. bar because mm-hmm. you want to continue working on it. You want to solve this life mm-hmm. problem.
You need a problem. You look, go looking for a problem to solve.
Yeah, well, you don't have to look for it. It look, you know, you can spot it across the room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see
yeah.
across the room. I mean, I did that literally with my husband. I was 15 years old. And I was in a restaurant, and I looked across, and there was a guy sitting with some friends, some people that I knew, and I thought, him, just like that. And the next day at school, I went to this person, I said, get me a date with this guy. And he said, you know, forget it. You have no idea what you're getting into. And I said, get me a date, right? And they did. And, like, you know, they've been married for, you know, I don't know, long time. Anyway, it'll be 50 soon. Years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That was a definite hit.
Yeah, it was. It was a definite hit. And I mean, I had similar things with other guys, you know, over time, because my husband, present husband now, and I, we weren't always an item. You know, we came and went sort of thing. But they were always a certain type of person with a certain kind of, you know, like there was real commonalities among the guys that I was attracted to. And I think that's the way it works. You know, I think we've
yeah, it's your range of experience.
I think you're right.
Childhood experience that determines your reactions.
Well, it was a huge part of your childhood, eh? So you have to, like, you can't just give up. Like, for example, Ellen just can't give up trying to solve the Joe problem, right? Mm. I mean,
it's like forever with her.
Yeah, exactly. It's like forever. But you have to learn how to deal with that and set boundaries and not necessarily marry these guys, you know what I mean? you have to learn
since
to be
we're moving
set.
Toward attachment theory here, I noticed just before the summary at the end of Ellen's story, Ellen speculates to Dr. Anderson that her parents' narrow range of emotional expression impaired the development of her own emotional functioning, mm-hmm. leaving her unprepared to recognize and tolerate feelings, particularly anger. And this, if I don't know, Eric must have gone over this in Dr. Alexander. He lists four main attachment styles that children can develop. Secure attachment styles occur when caregivers tend to respond quickly and consistently to infants' needs. Mm-hmm. Avoidant attachments are where caregivers tend to be somewhat unresponsive to their infant's distress, discouraging crying, and promote separation. Ambivalent attachments, the third kind, are formed when caregivers tend to behave in an inconsistent manner, with sometimes being indifferent to the infant's distress and other times being attentive, and then disorganized attachment styles. But Dr. Alexander concludes that adults who fell into one of these three insecure attachment types as children are more likely to be mistrustful and defensive, prone to pessimism, and have poor self-esteem, like the breeding ground of TMS. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what one of these attachment styles Ellen's relationship with her parents fell into. They had a narrow range of emotional expression, that it had impaired her development emotionally, how would you classify it? Was this disorganized attachment, ambivalent attachments, avoidant attachments? She obviously didn't have secure attachments, mm-hmm. which occur, he says, in... I forget, maybe 60% of the time.
I think she was secure in her attachments with the ones she could control. And the times that she was controlling, I think when she was married to Ted, the times that she was controlling with Ted, right? She was controlling of him. And needing others to feel our pain, I think everybody on here, one time or another, has needed others to feel your pain. But see, she's disassociated from that pain that she feels. So, like, we would, you know, go in what we call vent and let others know what we're thinking. But where she didn't even know what the emotional was. She didn't know what it was. So it was coming through in this rabbit and all these different dreams, and she was needing others to feel the pain for her.
I don't have dreams with animals that I'm using as intermediaries for my emotion that are so detached from my feelings. Like Ellen obviously has to work through this complex symbology that's also very detached and far away from her viscerally. She places the suffering in the rabbit or the cannibalistic rabbit. Mm-hmm. Or the boxer that dies, they're not her. She's getting very detached in her dream symbology. She's not directly, you feel that disconnect that she talks about between feeling and emotions in Dr. Anderson's analysis of their relationship, that extreme disconnect. I guess that's where that kind of that kind of symbolism arises in dreams when you do have that extreme disconnect. It's like a barometer of that. I don't have anything like that myself. Not that I can recall.
and you connect that to attachment styles, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
I mean, it would
her problem with her parents initially, that they were, they had a narrow range of emotional expression that had impaired the development of her own emotional functioning. So instead, she had these kind of dreams where she located really disturbing emotions in symbols, in animals. At least they're mammals.
I mean, when you talk about that, I didn't, as you were reading through the Alexander quote, I didn't follow all of it. But certainly, when you hear about how her parents treated her, the word that would jump to mind would be ambivalent. Like there is some positive connection. They want a connection, but they're not quite getting it. You were saying, Enjoy? You agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they obviously wanted a boy. I mean, the eldest child that was miscarried was a male child, and then they had Joe, and then 3 years later they have her, and they still wanted another boy. You know, so they're very, very they're very disconnected from her from that point of view, treating her like almost like another boy, and on and on. So yeah, there's some ambivalence for sure, and letting Joe abuse her, you know, not giving her any protection that you ordinarily would to any sibling who's 3 years younger, for heaven's sake, needs protection from an older kid. But, you know, parents have a tendency to say, oh, they're just playing, right? Mm-hmm. While a little one is getting pounded into the dirt.
I've certainly seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Younger little brother who gets beat up by the elder brother, and it becomes a pattern for life.
And it feels like it was a real betrayal to Ellen, where, you know, I could almost hear her voice in one of the phrases that Dr. Anderson wrote of, you know, just looking up, why aren't you protecting me? You know, like, and I think that would make it really hard to form a secure attachment with one's parents. Why aren't you protecting me from this guy? And I'm living in fear because I don't know when he's going to strike next.
Well, Dr. Alexander says that some of these, the least successful of these attachment patterns in childhood can lead to negative emotional patterns later in life. One of which is disconnection and rejection, wherein the person doubts that their needs for safety and security, as well as respect and acceptance, are able to be met. They have underlying beliefs in their own unworthiness and lack of confidence in the world at large. And that seems to get back to Ellen, to me. That's one of the dysfunctional type of emotional, negative emotional patterns that can arise from these early attachments, the early types of attachments in childhood. Mm-hmm. And then she gets back to her parents being blanks.
There is so much in this story, and unfortunately, I think we're coming to the end of the hour. Does anyone have any final thoughts that you want to add as we begin to wrap up? We have a couple minutes left.
Well, I think it's been lots of fun. I mean, there's so much in, you know, that we can talk about in each one of these that it could take us years to go through a book. So, you know, that's a little worrisome. But the fact is if we go over it superficially, we're not going to get as much out of it. So I think it's great and fun.
I'm really glad that we decided to do another day on this. I think there is so much in this story. And I also want to thank everyone who showed up. We probably have, I don't know, maybe 14 people in the chat room now. Or on the call. So thank you all for joining us. Any other final thoughts?
I think these calls is really helping people understand that when they have a dream, it's just not, you know, just a dream. It is our body trying to tell us something, trying to direct us in a place of healing and love. And that's what it all goes down to, you know?
Yeah.
Completion. Getting to that point of completion. And that was my last thing is after 9 years, she was totally healed, even though she didn't know what the dreams meant, right?
I mean, I think that she's still there may be some emotional work to do. I think that within maybe 6 months or 4 months or a year, I think her physical symptoms were gone. But
yeah.
Often, you know, it's kind of the Lassie theory. The physical symptoms are a signal that there's something else deeper that may take a little while to work on. It, you know, it sounds like she had a pretty some of those emotions were pretty overwhelming towards her.
Yeah.
Well, to summarize Ellen's relationship with her therapist, Dr. Anderson, this therapy went on for 9 years, and she was first referred to, Ellen was first referred to Dr. Anderson by Dr. Sarno because of her physiophobia and lower back pain. Of course, she had an extreme fear of physical activities, and the resolution of her symptoms followed a pattern like this. After 8 weeks, 35% resolution, 3 months, 40% resolution, and after a year, the resolution of the residual pain had occurred. It was almost all gone, except that she had a pattern of pain eruption during periods of emotional stress that continued on, I imagine, through this period of therapy over 9 years. Which I think we all notice with TMS.
Yes, true.
When you get stressed out, you'll feel a tinge, a sting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe we can close up with the closing paragraph of the chapter. In her words, in Ellen's words, it'll make you crazy to feel 40 years of what was repressed in such a concentrated fashion. That's how it became so overwhelming for her.
Wow.
I'm afraid I'll go mad, like one of the dream boxers, if I feel the pain. Nevertheless, Ellen's courage and determination were inspiring. She stated, "When I come to the session, I bring a bag of courage. Let's go." It seems to me that our therapy process was, in large part, a kind of championing of Ellen by attempting to tolerate hearing about, quote, her story, unquote, to stay in the room with her as she is trying to tell us. In giving me permission to share our work in this chapter, Ellen said that she hopes that her experience, presented in this way, will prove helpful to others. Our shared belief in the benefits of attempting to recognize and tolerate feelings, which I think is a theme of this book, in order to relieve physical symptoms, has helped us endure and prevail. So I want to thank everyone for joining us today. We have a mere minute left before the next event starts. So in deference to Jan A., our moderator in the chat room, I want to wrap things up. Thanks, everyone, so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to this. We've discussed what book we may do next. Bruce seems pretty excited about the James Alexander book, so maybe he'll get his way.
Who is Eric?
Anyway, I'm going to wrap things up, and I hope to see you all next week.